Bring the House Transportation Committee to order. Tuesday, 1:30, present Representative Dugan, Salmon, Newman, Faircloth, and Keller. First order of business is ruling of the chair on telephone ringing. Even though we weren't gaveled in, I think we're in the room, and Representative Keller is in debt for donuts.
Darn.
Or some other reasonable spectrum.
He brought his phone to the committee, and it
he brought it.
I guess I'll just have to sit over there.
Before we have Mr. Otteson come up, is there anything that the committee has before we begin? Seeing none, today we'll be doing. Did you have some? Go ahead. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. I just wanted to say that I did receive but have not had time to review a letter that was generated by the department, and I'm not sure if all committee members have received that, but it is in my possession, so I appreciate the response. Haven't read them yet, but.
Thank you. And Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to add to, at the chair's request, Department of Transportation moved back the deadline so that this committee could review the 2030 plan, and I commend the chair for getting that done for us. We can look at it so the public has a chance to look at that and to be a little more informed, and for the DOT to be able to make that happen. But, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newman. And we've been joined by Representative Johnson. And again, before I call Jeff up, I want to thank the department for their flexibility. I know that it does have an impact on your process of getting the new STIP out, but I understand through the commissioner that this extension should not affect your process, and everything will be A-OK. So we'd welcome Mr. Otteson to the witness table. I wish we had frequent testifier miles to give you, but we don't.
Starting to feel like that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for coming, and we appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's good to see you all again. And today the topic is a little different. It's the 2030 plan rather than the STIP process. And I wanted to give you first, if I could, an answer to a question last week about efficiencies that we're employing. And I didn't give you really a very thoughtful answer. A couple things didn't come to mind at that moment, but there are some things that we can report, and this will just take a minute, if I may.
Yes.
The three things that I can point to is we, a couple of years ago, identified a software package that helps you optimize the route selection of a new route when you're working in through terrain and you have things like wetlands and historic properties and any of a dozen other considerations, including cut fill, haul balances of cut fill. Software is developed by the Australian Roads Commission. They then took it commercial. It has since been sold to Trimble, which is a company here in the United States, and is used in six continents to identify roads, including about seven or eight DOTs. So we have identified that software. I wish I could tell you that we bought it. We can't. It's actually sold on a per-use basis by the mile. So you rent the software per project per mile. And we did negotiate, the company, the only exception to their worldwide pricing policy. And we were able to tell them that our low-volume roads deserved a lower price than, say, a four-lane freeway in Texas. So that's one example. Another example is one we're actually demonstrating right now with public safety and the Anchorage Police Department is a camera that you can use to photograph a crime scene. And I'll get to engineering in a minute. And in that photograph, it allows you to do measurements after the fact, very accurate measurements. So you can photograph the crime scene or the accident scene, take measurements, use them in court, do a lot of things that now are done by hand, and accelerate the opening of a freeway or a high highway after a fatal accident, which often can take hours to clear. It's a very expensive camera. It's over $200,000. But its engineering application is that it can also be used to photograph like a very busy intersection and allow you to do measurements without having to put people out in traffic lanes. You can photograph a bridge from different angles and get, and the state of Washington DOT identified it last year as their technology of the year for those applications. So we're now going to be using that here in Alaska, and it has both highway safety benefits and engineering benefits. The third one, and one we implemented, is a technology called Video Log. Video Log is where you drive down the road and take a lot of pictures. Those pictures can be used, then put on the web and viewed by the engineers to look at the roadway, say on a day like today when the road is covered with snow and it's hard to get out, the daylight is short. They can sit in their offices and see that roadway in optimal conditions. Very high resolution photographs. There's 1,200 of them taken per mile. So, and it's indexed in a way that it makes measurements possible of the assets on the roadway. And that's unique. Among all the states, only one other state's been able to do that particular trick, is to have it indexed in a way that you can actually do measurement, so we can do asset inventory in a very cost-effective manner, as opposed to putting people in the field measuring things manually. So it has two benefits, asset inventory and for engineering, and the feedback I'm getting from engineers in the field that are using this that are saying, this is wonderful. This allows us to see every detail of that roadway sitting in their office, be it Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau, without a field trip, without travel, and without dealing with things like traffic control and bad weather and snow cover, et cetera. So those are three efficiencies.
With that camera, would it be applicable to things like aviation? I know there's, how many strips do you have out, you know?
Many.
Is it applicable to information you need to gather in aviation or marine highways or any other part of
it? Well, the LiDAR camera, it could be applicable to marine highways, I would think. I don't know about aviation, but it's possible. We could certainly, once we get a camera, we can use it for anything. Yeah. It's I understand law enforcement's very intrigued with it. The FBI is using it for crime scene investigation and can measure the diameter of a bullet hole off of a picture. So that gives you some idea of the accuracy it provides.
Representative Newman had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Addison, I just wondered, you were talking about this. Now, this equipment, this camera, they're all included in your current budget, right? I mean,
Yes, the camera is coming out of highway safety funds. And the idea is we provide two of them to law enforcement to start, one for the Anchorage PD and one to the state troopers, probably located in Palmer. And we would then use those, you know, with at a time the DOT would use those and be under on demand. We would take it back to whatever the accident scene was if an accident occurred on that same day.
Well, I commend you, because something that I've been trying to pound into a lot of the commissioners is trying to get departments to work together. So you working with public safety on this and transportation in a combined area, what, you know, we talk about it a lot, but yeah, I think this is the first time I've actually seen it happen.
If we get a chance later in the session, I'd love to talk to you about a strategic highway safety plan and just that, the departments working together. It was really quite a remarkable effort. And my one-minute spiel for highway safety is it's a remarkably big problem, and we need to do more as a state. And this plan, I think, goes a long ways to identifying the scope of the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, with that, I'm ready to begin, Mr. Chairman. I know I'd like to talk about schedule first, because schedule has really been the key issue on people's minds, including Representative Newman's comments here before we gaveled in. There's a diagram in there in your chart made from Excel about a two-year timeline. That diagram basically shows you the schedule we thought we were following starting in the summer of 2006 when the regulations were issued in draft form that governed this planning process. We knew then we had a potential problem and if getting everything done that we had to get done. We had to get done under that a long-range transportation plan in a certain amount of time. We also had to get done a strategic highway safety plan, which I just mentioned, and that was even on a shorter time frame. That was due to be done by September of last year with about a $13 million consequence. If we didn't get it done, we'd lose that much money. As the summer of 06 wore on, we also knew we were going to have a new administration, which added another dimension to the problem. You couldn't really be starting a policy plan when one way or another there was going to be a new governor here in Juneau come December of that year. So whatever we did, we had to wait for the new administration to get on board. So our solution to that was we will update the STIP, because the STIP is the thing that is really the tool that USDOT is using to control the completion of the plan. The plan has to be complete before we can amend the STIP. That's the controlling factor. So we said, let's have a STIP that's amended before the deadline, which was July of last year. We will then be able to extend the time that we process the plan, given the fact that we'd have a new administration. And our plan was we would have this long-range plan done by approximately the end of 2006, at which time the STIP would have carried us across that gap in time of about 6 months. The next wrinkle, the card that got dealt that we couldn't anticipate, was the way the money was allocated at the start of 2008, in September of last year. And I talked about that a little bit in the STIP presentation, about how we had a change in how much apportionment we're receiving, and that has changed our flexibility. We now have to spend dollars in categories we weren't planning on spending it in, specifically more safety projects and more bridge projects, less highway reconstruction projects. And the only way we can change the STIP to then spend those dollars in this fiscal year is to get the plan done and then to do a STIP amendment, and then we will be ready to do the project work that will enable us to not lose those dollars. So I know this is confusing. If you kind of look at this, you see where that first horizontal band of red is. That's really where we lost our flexibility. That's when we said, oops, we need to do a STIP amendment now, but we had to complete the long-range transportation plan and then do a STIP amendment. And you see there those arrows right below or between the two red lines. You see that short amount of red arrow there near the bottom? That's the amount of time that will be left to obligate funds at the end of this fiscal year, after first completing the long-range plan and then completing the STIP amendment. So we're taking a very, very generous amount of time, 10, 11 months, and compressing it into 2 to 3 months under the schedule right now. There's really no one here to blame. We thought we had a plan. It was identified, given all the facts ahead of us, the new change in governor, the requirement to do everything, the fact that we were also working on a separate planning document. But when those notices arrived in October, all our well-laid plans were basically undone. So if that's, I suspect that may not be entirely clear, because it's a lot of material here, but I'd be happy to go over that further so you understand. That's the push. That's why we tried to do this plan quickly. And it's because we have literally tens of millions of dollars of state funding that's at risk.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Addison, when I'm reading this, it says state funds obligated by September. When I look at the code for red, extreme deadlines or unexpected events, why were these unexpected events? Did this something, you keep saying that this all has to get compressed. How did this jump up at you so you finally happened?
And I've been in the business 20 years, and I talk to people who have been there longer. They've never seen us lose the flexibility with apportionments that we lost in October of last year.
So it has to do with the fact
it has to do with these rescissions and what these rescissions are doing. Okay. And just a quick word about rescissions. Rescissions are a take back of apportionment, which in most cases is hollow. It's not real dollars, okay? It's just a promise that's never been fulfilled. But when they leave that on our books, it gives us latitude to adjust to whatever we need to do when we have a project slip. If one project slips, we need to put another project in. That's the federal system. Use those dollars or lose them. But if you lose flexibility with apportionment, you now have to substitute like for like. If your bridge project is delayed, you have to have another bridge project of about the same dollar amount ready to go. If a safety project, same thing. And that historically, we've never had to worry about like for like. We've always been able to substitute any type of project for any type of project. And so the change in October of last year, I still describe it internally as literally turning our world upside down in how we manage projects. I don't know to this day that all of our staff fully understand its implications. We've spent time in talking to them, explaining to them, but for a lot of people in DOT, what they really want to know is, what's my budget, what's my schedule, let me get it done. And they don't want to deal with these arcane rules of the funding itself. So there's just a few of us that have to suffer those rules. So I hope that answers your question, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the plan itself, there's a PowerPoint presentation I'd like to go through. On the bottom of page one, there's the question, why another plan? Well, the feds make us do it. In a simple nutshell, there's a requirement in Safety Lou that we not only have a statewide long-range transportation plan, but that we update it to meet new requirements that were contained in Safety Lou. In our state, we have chosen to treat the long-range plan as what I call a top-level plan, a strategic plan, a policy plan. Those are the kinds of words you see used in other states. About a third of the states do it in that approach. And some states, to pick on a state that I know that doesn't do it that way, is Kansas. But Kansas doesn't have ferries. They don't have aviation. They have a very simple state highway system. They don't do a lot of local roads. So it's fairly easy for them to write a one plan that covers all their needs and get it done. State of Alaska, huge geography, lots of different systems, very diverse sets of needs between urban areas and rural areas. Trying to do one plan that covered everything and was the definitive plan, there was no other document to turn to, would just be a huge job, and I don't think it's possible. So we do it in a tiered approach. The policy plan is literally kind of a high-level, 30,000-foot view of where the state needs to go, but it leaves to those other planning documents the details. Their job is to flesh out the details, be it a modal plan, like an aviation plan or marine highway plan, or a geographically constrained plan, like the Anchorage long-range plan, like the Southwest Alaska transportation plan, or there's other topics too. We have plans for safety, we have plans for ITS, we have plans for other subsets. And if you look at AS 44, 42, 050, you'll find that state law actually provides, just for what I'm talking about, a tiered plan done in multiple documents. So on page two, I'm speaking here with what I just said at the top of three. This plan is a policy plan. It's not a list of projects. We don't want it to be so unrealistic that we just say, well, the sky is blue and the future is rosy, and let's go build everything we need to build. We wanted this plan to have one overriding message. There's been a change in funding. There's been a change in the national level. There's been a change in what the dollars accomplished, and we think that was the key message to get out. If we don't do something different as a state, our dreams for transportation will be in peril. And so when we started this plan, we said that's the key message. We have to communicate that one thing, if nothing else, in this planning document.
Mr. Addison.
Please.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Addison, does that mean that the 2030 plan doesn't have that anything can be put in the STIP? Let me try this again. I read the 2030 plan, which is to say a member of my staff read the 2030 plan.
Understand.
And there were some projects that were specifically mentioned, and always under the rubric of you know, among others, or
giving an example.
Right. Could you submit a 2030 plan that didn't have any projects in it and then write whatever you wanted into the STIP? Does some proportion of them have to be in the 2030 plan? What's the relationship?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, you could submit a plan that didn't have a single project listed. We felt that would not be accurate to explain to people what we mean by system expansion or system betterment, that you have to give some kind of example for what those projects mean. But it is not an attempt. If you read the plan, we're not attempting to let those named projects truly serve as, well, that one got named, so it has to go forward. In fact, some of the projects we named are actually past the planning stage and in the implementation stage. So, you know, the plan is really sort of a moot question. They've already been identified in a system plan, and they're going forward. The example of that might be highway to highway in Anchorage. It's in the long-range transportation plan, which is legally binding, and does have a tie to the STIP and the Anchorage TIP. But it's those examples are in there to illustrate for people what we mean by this. Even our list of what we call strategic projects, $5.5 billion, and we talk in there about that. We know what that list is in. We deliberately not made that list part of the plan, because to do so would let everyone argue over the non-essential point. The point is not which projects are in that $5.5 billion. The point is we can't build that $5.5 billion without something being different on the funding side. It's sort of moot to talk about the projects if there isn't enough money to build the list. And the $5.5 billion is a subset of needs, not the entire list, and that's the key point. We can't even build an important subset of needs, even if we could all sit at the table and agree what the subset is. And, you know, we have to constrain further, and that's really what we're trying to say is the current funding stream will only get you so far against this broad set of needs in the state. The other thing about the plan I should talk about is just that the funding itself that's shown in the plan kind of ignores the question of eligibility. It treats all the funding we get as essentially this, you know, one color: aviation dollars, highway dollars, marine highway operating dollars, etc. And that's only to make the point, at the macro level, at the 30,000 foot level, how are we doing? We're not trying to say, well, we need to shift aviation dollars to highways or ferry dollars to something else, that, because that can't happen legally. We understand that. But the key point is there are some real holes between what we think we need to do as an owner of a transportation system and what our means is to address those ownership responsibilities. So,
follow up.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So there's no relationship between what's mentioned in the 2030 plan and what's in the STIP. That is, it doesn't make it more likely that a project's going to get into the STIP if it's in 2030. It doesn't make it less likely if it's not.
It might make it more likely at some point, not in the STIP, but it might make it more likely in the long, in those subordinate plans. So if you're writing an area plan, just pick a region for the YK Delta, and you propose to build an 8,000 foot strip, you know, when the policy is we should be building 3,300 foot strips because we have so many needs, we need to allocate funds judiciously, then that project, well, we would probably tell the authors of that regional plan, you can't make that recommendation. It isn't consistent with being, you know, kind of being fair with the money and making it serve as many user groups as possible. So it might constrain what goes in a subordinate plan, which then would constrain what goes into a spending plan, but it's not, we're not trying to make this long-range plan, and we can put those kind of words in the front end of the document if that would make people more comfortable. We deliberately keep this as a policy plan, as a strategic vision, with a message about funding, and we think that's really the takeaway message coming out of this plan. The truth is, most of our long-range plans up until now have been yawners. They have been sat on the shelf, and they have not drawn much interest. For some reason, this one caught interest, and it's kind of been an interesting phenomenon.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
So, at the
Representative Keller, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
You
just scratched my nose.
Okay. Representative Newman.
Thank you. Just while we're on that, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Addison, when you're talking about long-range plans, and here it says it addresses DOT's responsibilities as an owner, and what it does do and what it doesn't do. Here's the problem I have.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can help me in a way to explain this to my constituents and the people who work in the communities I represent. I had members from the Mansu Borough in my office saying, we need more money for roads. We need more dump trucks, or we need more plow trucks out there. They're not plowing them fast enough. And I said, well, you know, the state has a lot of responsibilities, and we're trying to do the best that we can. How do I communicate with these people that what DOT's job is and what they aren't doing? A lot of times there's a mix between borough roads and state roads. You know, particularly in my district, there's a lot of construction going on, a lot of borough roads, and we, my office gets in the mix between, we need money for these roads, they're borough roads, state roads. What's the best answer that I can give to them as far as responsibilities for DOT and local government? And maybe Representative Fairclough could help with that one.
Well, Representative Newman, through the chair, you ask a very good question, and it's one I often talk to our staff about internally. The public doesn't care who owns the road. The public only cares that the road they're driving on is safe and smooth and appropriate to their needs. That's the honest truth. And when we start talking about, well, this organization owns this road and that organization owns that road and you need to talk to them about this, we in the bureaucracy start to look pretty, you know, picayune-ish. There's just no way around that. We can provide maps for you to show these distinctions. There is a hierarchy of roads in the state. There are roads owned by the state, and then there are roads owned by boroughs and cities and other entities too, be they federal or tribal, etc. And so there's really quite a connection out there, or I would say a collection of ownership, but the vast majority of the public don't understand those distinctions, and so we struggle in our business to make that clear.
If I may, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. What you've just told me is that maybe you could get me some idea or something that I could transfer or get to them that says, okay, here's what the state does and here's what maybe you need to be doing.
We can certainly make maps, and we have made maps that show that. We have maintenance district maps that show for each maintenance district what are the routes. And it actually gets a little more confusing than just ownership, because sometimes maintenance of roads is cross-shared. We may maintain local roads. They may maintain state roads where it makes sense, and we have agreements.
Requirements that are, I know it, we've got one where a local RSA that some of the crack seals in the dirt roads that the state owns if the state does the high-speed plowing, and so there's, I mean, right down to the local road service area, so.
We actually maintain a list of all state roads that are owned. We keep it updated. It's actually a statutory requirement. It's now accessible. It's accessible on the web at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, before we go on, I appreciate the line of questioning from Representative Dugan. I think that's a lot of the frustration of exactly what this document is and how it affects future projects. And indeed, from what I hear, it's kind of inching the, I keep using big ship analogies. I mean, you know, if you see in the long-range plan that, you know, as a policy you're going to concentrate over here, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, it's going to specifically affect projects, but then again, I hear it could specifically project or affect projects, so.
Far more likely those subordinate plans, Southeast Alaska Plan, the Marine Highway System Plan, the Aviation System Plan, those are the ones that are really doing the project prioritization, the project selection.
So if I were a constituent on the street, I think you characterized it, Representative Dugan, as when we had the meeting, the commissioner here, is it a hoop that we're jumping through? Just jump through a hoop? It seems like it's sort of like that, but it has a little bit of an effect. So if I were a constituent in my district, I would want to concentrate obviously on the modal plans as the point of impact and input for my.
They would be far more meaningful in terms of actually allocating resources in the short term. The as far as jumping in hoops, you could characterize it as jumping through hoops. I have said that before in front of one of our advisory bodies that we had used to help develop this plan, and I kind of got some backlash from doing that because they said, well, if we're just jumping through a hoop, then why are we here? Why are we spending our valuable time coming to this meeting? And I had to then honor their presence by reminding them and reminding myself that we're treating this plan and we are now as a true call to arms for the state of recognition. Things have changed. The funding picture has gone from kind of green to yellow to perhaps red in terms of a caution flag, and we need to do something. And I think that's really what the message that I think is, I believe, is the takeaway message, is that if we don't do something different, our expectations as a state, as citizens, needs to come to grips with what we're actually going to be able to accomplish. And that's, if that's one takeaway message, is what the plan is meant to say. And I think that's more than a hoop. I think that's a very important message.
Anybody on that side? Representative Newman?
No, I just wonder if I get what you just said in writing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if there's still administrative philosophy to participate in the upgrade and trade for some of the roads in the municipality. Is that something that needs to be included in this plan? So, and for those of you that don't know, it's where we upgrade the roads and then we give it to the municipality and they, from that point forward, maintain it, kind of a way for us to get out from under some of those roads. Is that something that needs to be in this plan? Has it been considered? Is it still on the table? Exactly, I guess, help me understand where.
Well, Representative Johnson, through the chair, I think that's a good point. You know, as I think through the individual strategies, I don't believe that is actually listed, and that's one I believe we should list because it has been a long-standing policy almost my entire 20 years at DOT. You know, we need to devolve ourselves, and in fact, one of the uproars over this plan was not enough about ports and harbors, not enough about ports and harbors. And we kind of said, we've been devolving ourselves from ports and harbors for 20 years. I mean, it started when the price of oil plunged below 10 in the, you know, the second half of the 80s, and the state started, you know, as Joe Perkins used to say, I walk around with quitclaim deeds in my back pocket. He'll sign over a quitclaim deed on a moment's notice. And we have done that. We have transferred a lot of facilities, be they harbor facilities or road facilities, and we'll continue to do so, provided we can find the money to do that upgrade. That's sort of the
follow-up.
Yeah, and I guess the point is, and unlike Representative Dugan, my staff has not read through the entire 2030 plan. Is that something that we need to have in here as an overriding 30,000-foot view, that it is our philosophy that we want to do that? If not, are we excluding ourselves from not doing that? Is it in the plan, first question? Secondly, if it's not, have we limited ourselves with our ability by not including it to doing it? Or could that be, you know, one of the hoops we can jump through in one of the later...
Well, that's the sort of policy that often comes from the legislature, so it doesn't really need to be in the plan. But my feeling is right now, unless someone were to tell me that we shouldn't do that, I would propose that we add that in as one of the strategies under our efficiency, our overall efficiency proposal, because it does make DOT more efficient. DOT in Alaska manages far more roads than the typical state DOT around the country. We're managing about 40% of the road miles in the state. Many of them are truly what you call local class roads. Those are artifacts of early statehood when local governments weren't all that well equipped to do that kind of work. But the national average is about 20%. In some states, the DOT is managing no more than 10% of the miles of road in those states. So that kind of gives you the big picture.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I cannot speak for the legislature, but I can speak for this legislator. And I would certainly encourage you to include that in the 2030 plan as a philosophy and an overriding view to see if we couldn't get to that 20% number, somewhere closer to that 20% number, and divest ourselves of some of those municipal roads within municipalities that we really shouldn't. That should be serviced, and I think we can solve a lot of the problems that Representative Newman was talking about who owns what, if we could get to a point where we divest ourselves of some of those and get them upgraded. So I think that ought to be part of this 2030 plan, strictly speaking from a personal basis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fairclough?
On that point, I would just caution urban members, be careful what you wish for. When you enter projects like that, you have long-term obligations that go out into the future that you burden people who from some urban areas may think they pay an extraordinary amount of taxes and bonding capacity already. And so, you know, again, from my service prior to this body, we have been involved in my community before taking over roads, and it does create clarity for who is responsible for the snow being on them, but it also adds obligations about a decade out in the future of when you have to repair them locally and do that. So I just, you know, I think that as a state representative, we certainly need to look for ways to reduce the state's responsibility, and from that perspective, I think it should be included in the plan. But as far as the community members that I represent, I feel it an error in my way not to say that that could in the future cause them to have a bond before them that would require them over the next 30 years to have to pay for that improvement out of their own pockets.
If I can move on, a message has certainly been heard. Slide 4, we're trying to address the state's responsibilities, and these are the modes that we're looking at primarily. Obviously, there's some question about ports and harbors that I've already discussed. We are amplifying the ports and harbors discussion. And I should add, we have reached tentative agreement with two other organizations, Denali Commission and the Corps of Engineers, to do a three-way study of the state's port and harbor needs, because it's kind of long overdue. One, it hasn't been done in a long time. Two, there have been a lot of changes in what is needed out there, everything from the change in shipping lanes due to the diminishing ice to the fisheries in western Alaska, just to the changes and evolution that have gone on in fisheries, all gravitate toward a need to look hard at what our ports and harbors needs across the state. So there's a supplemental request in the 2008 capital budget to fund the state's share of that study that I think was announced this week or released this week.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've heard testimony in the committee that basically we're building a lot of stuff that isn't highways or bridges or anything that's in any of these circles. We're building bike trails in some areas. We're building sidewalks. Where did those fit in here?
Well, through the chair, Representative Dugan, those are really sort of ancillary parts of the highway system. They tend to occupy the same right-of-way. They tend to be part of it would that system. So, you know, we are occasionally building them not in the same right-of-way, but those generally are getting transferred to local government. you know, some of the trail systems in Anchorage that follow the green belts. There's one here in Juneau along the Menahal River that was transferred. But by and large, the trails that we build that are part of the highway system, they're just part of our responsibility. And they're actually talked about in the plan. There is discussion of them. And we, in fact, internally, we ask ourselves, are we doing a good enough job of keeping track of them? Because right now, all of our asset inventory tools are focused on the highway itself. They aren't focused on those other features. So we think this new video log tool will allow us to do a better job of getting the grips of just how many miles of this and that that we own.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I were on the department's budget subcommittee, which by golly I am, and I wanted to find out what the department was doing to maintain, and by that I also mean clear, sidewalks and trails associated with state-maintained roadways, that would be included somehow in the sort of giant maintenance fund for all roads statewide? Is that how that would work?
Yes, that's how it works. It would be part of the highway, part of our operating budget. And in fact, we identified in our strategic highway safety plan, we identified clearing those pathways as an important part of safety, because you can't expect people to be walking on those things when there's 10 feet of snow heaped on them. And then suddenly they're out walking right on the edge of the travel lane. In fact, I came very close to hitting someone last night who was doing just that, and walking right on the edge of the lane in the dark, wearing dark clothing, and I had my own little moment of fear.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are those numbers broken out in the detail books?
Well, they wouldn't be broken out, but between trails and highways. That would all be in the same operating budget because it's the same forces, the same equipment. And the only way you could measure it would be to sort of spend an awful lot of time keeping track of, you know, the hours of the day spent on one or the other.
Representative Dugan?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I'm informed that it isn't the same equipment, at least in some cases.
Yeah, in some cases not.
Typically the equipment the department uses to clear roadways can't be used for either sidewalks or trails. And that, in fact, at least in my, not just in my district, but in the entirety of the municipality of Anchorage, that the department doesn't have any equipment to keep sidewalks and trails clear.
I think it's probably fair to say that we are not doing as good a job as I think perhaps we should do, and it boils down to the managers will tell you, I've only got so much money. I do with it what I can. And that kind of comes out in here, where, you know, we're underfunded in maintenance. If you look at that maintenance chart, you know, the costs have gone up with inflation, and the funding has not kept track with that. So,
Representative Salmon?
I have a question. It's probably a little out of the ordinary, but I know we're talking about the 2030 plan, but over in Red Devil, I know Kuskokwim, upriver from Aniak,
mm-hmm.
There's an airport at Red Devil that doesn't have an airport. I was kind of wondering, maybe they could get some information, you know, to my office, see why they're not putting a light in on
the
airport.
I think we could take that up as a separate question with the new Deputy Commissioner for Aviation coming on board here in a couple of days, Christine Klein.
Yeah.
And
because it does, you know, it's a matter of life and death,
right,
when you have a situation like that.
Right. There are, you know, if you look at our effort, we're trying to bring airports up to the 3,300-foot standard in many areas of the state that are still lacking. Of course, we're kind of now facing the hardest of the hards. You know, the easy ones have been done, the less expensive ones. Some of these now, due to terrain, due to water bodies, we're facing just very expensive prospects. So the pace has slowed per year because of the higher cost. But the goal is to give every village access to a minimum 3,300-foot strip.
So. And Dave, when do we have an aviation come in?
The 7th, next Thursday.
So next Thursday we'll have the aviation division in.
Maybe they could get the question
I'll make sure that they're prepared to answer that question.
I mean, it should be fairly simple. I mean, it's been on the books for a long time.
If I may continue, Mr. Chair, on slide five, you...
Yeah, hold on a second. I'm sorry.
Before we go on, I want to expand a little bit on Representative Dugan's question. I have several roads in my district that are state roads, but it looks like I see municipal, and this is the confusion, I see municipal snowplow doing the trail. Do we compensate them for that? Do we pay them to do that, or are they just doing that out of the kindness of their heart?
It's usually done with cross agreement, with some sort of a shared responsibility.
You do this, we'll do that.
Yeah, they've got the right equipment to do that job. You do that, and we'll do something for you with our equipment. So those are typically written down, although in some cases they're over the top of the hood of the truck, as two maintenance superintendents talk to each other. But we are trying to make those formal and identify them. It's important if you were to get into a tort claim or something like that there be some written responsibility.
So I just wanted to clarify who was doing it.
Well, on slide five, the only thing this slide's trying to show you, these are all indexed to 100 at the time of statehood, is that our population is about tripled since statehood, but our use of the roadways in terms of VMT or vehicle miles of travel and the number of vehicles registered have both gone up three times faster than population. So you know, this is a remarkable statistic when you consider the fraction of Alaska that's really unroaded. You got almost 30% of the state's population not on a road system. So we actually have some of the highest registration of vehicles. I think we have more vehicles than we have people in this state, which is an unusual trend. Most states, it's the other way around.
Jeff, how many of those are actually running on the road?
Not that many on a day like today, Mr. Chairman. I think I won't belabor slide number six. You've seen a similar slide in the presentation last week. The price of things is going up. It's going up in Alaska faster than it is elsewhere in the United States. And that is just played into what's happening to the dollars and what they're able to achieve. On slide number seven, no surprise here, we're heavily dependent upon federal receipts. And you can see those three bands. The top two bands have not changed that much. Their thickness is about the same over several years, whereas the federal band is where all the growth has been. So for a state that relies so extensively on federal funds, if something happens to that source of funds, we are clearly at risk, and there's lots of discussion of that could happen. There could be changes.
Did you have a question?
No.
I was just going like this.
I would just offer a silent prayer for Senator Stevens' health.
Yes. On slide number seven, where can I find the revenues for the rest of the roads in the state?
Well, these are not revenues for roads, because our revenues for roads, through the form of vehicle registration fees and gas taxes, go to the general fund. They don't go to a dedicated transportation fund. And so we then appropriate out of the general fund money to maintain things, would be it the operating costs for the Marine Highway System or the operating costs for the roads and the aviation system. And that what you're seeing there in the red band is those operating cost appropriations. So coming out of the general fund, but you don't see the dollar-to-dollar relationship. I can tell you that right now what goes into the general fund from vehicle registration fees and gas taxes, it's pretty close to dollar for dollar what comes out for maintaining the road. So they're roughly the same, but there is no tie. In fact, I learned yesterday we're the only state among 50 now that does not have a transportation fund of some sort. Now, all other states have done this either statutorily or constitutionally. Our state has, for reasons of the Constitution and other reasons, has never chose to go there. So we are dependent upon federal funds, and it's kind of like you know, your stock market philosophy. Putting all your eggs in one basket has a risk, and that's sort of the risk we're running right now. We're very dependent upon federal funds.
Thank you. Representative Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, following up on Representative Johnson's comments about personal responsibility inside of particular municipalities or regions in Alaska, I noticed that it's mentioned inside of 2030 about increasing or looking to local communities to match, but is there any way to incentivize local communities to qualify faster for highway federal dollars coming in by coming up with more of a local match? Is that inside of your strategy?
Representative Fairclough, through the chair, in fact, our STIP selection criteria do that now. They actually reward communities with higher points when they contribute more than just match, be that the design or the other, you know, the donation of right-of-way or donation of materials. So they actually get extra points in the selection process, which would mean they have a chance of going, their project might go sooner than another community that didn't do that.
But it is true that under the STIP that we put roads or other transportation modes in without any kind of local community match.
We do, but several years ago the legislature put some intent language in there about local governments providing their own match for these projects, and we have been implementing that policy. And how our policy works is we kind of look at the class of road. Roads are characterized by a scheme called functional class. When they start at the top with the very, very high-level roads, the primary arterials, which would be the NHS and the major arterials in a community, Egan Drive here in town, Tudor Road, Glen Highway would all be arterials. As you move down the functional class, you move into what are called collectors, major collectors and minor collectors, and then eventually you get to what are called local roads. And those are, every road in the state gets classified under this system. The DOT does it, but we do it under strict guidelines and the oversight of Federal Highway Administration, who requires that we produce this functional class study. And so our policy says major collector and above, regardless of ownership, the state will match, because those really are roads that serve broad state interests. They carry a heavy amount of traffic. In fact, one way to look at it is our major collectors and our arterials, get the statistics right here, represent 30% of our road miles. But they're carrying about 80% to 90% of our traffic in the state. They clearly are where the economy occurs. They are where our state, you know, its economy wins or doesn't win when those roads are well maintained. So there's a very, very high interest in those, regardless of ownership. Roads below that threshold, we start to require local match to participate. And I should add, historically, federal aid dollars have never been able to go below major collector. That has always been the federal scheme, and in 49 other states it remains the federal scheme. Only in Alaska are we eligible to spend federal dollars on the lower tiers of the functional class system. It's good on one hand because it allows village roads to use these dollars and local roads in general, whether they be village or suburban or even urban, but it's the old adage, when everything's a priority, then nothing's a priority. And so that's the counter side of it.
So the more, so we have a criteria pointing system inside of the regulatory,
yes,
side of the code that provides higher points. What's the percentage match? That's the baseline.
It depends upon the apportionment of funds, but the general rule is about 9% match and 91% federal.
That's what you're asking for. And yeah. So if a community comes up with 10%, they score higher.
Yeah, they get, for every, I'd have to go and check the criteria, but for every few percentage points above that minimum, they would get extra points.
And that's what I was going to ask, if there was a point trade-off.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Addison, can you provide me with that information so I can get it to some of my communities about how that works? And do those communities have direct access to those federal funds, or do they have to go to state DOT first? Is there, you know, what's the procedures on that? If you could get that to me, I would greatly appreciate it so I get to my communities.
I'll certainly get you the information. The answer to your second question is that the federal funds first flow to the DOT. We're responsible not only for deciding where they go, we're also responsible for when a local government executes a project with federal dollars, we have carry all fiduciary responsibility. So if the local government makes a mistake, the state is responsible, unless you have a very strong agreement with your local government. And
if you can give me those steps, procedures, and how it's done, I'd really appreciate
that.
We'll go Representative Johnson, then Salmon, and then Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There has been, and I want to go back to what Representative Fairclough was talking about a little bit. There have been either real or perceived overbuilding of roads in Anchorage. To maybe where they're built to a major collector standard when really the traffic doesn't merit that. So if I understand what you're saying, that is not necessary to receive the grants. and that wouldn't be a motivation for overbuilding those roads? Is there a situation in the past where they've been overbuilt just to get the money when it wasn't necessary for the merited by the traffic? And has that changed to where now you could build an appropriate capacity road and not overbuild it? Or is that just a perception that the community has that this is way too much road? Or is it real that it was done to generate money? And if so, did we generate more money than we needed? And sort of, are we shooting ourselves by overbuilding some of our roads and feeders and major collectors?
Representative Johnson, the easy answer is the money is not driving the standard. The standard is a matter of a choice. If it's a state road, it would be a state standard. I know the municipality of Anchorage has adopted standards that worry about things like a place to put snow in the wintertime, so that when you plow snow, there's adequate room for snow storage. Or maybe it's an issue at an intersection, and how if you have a lot of long trucks in Anchorage, 53 footers that are moving around, so they need to turn safely at intersections. Those things start to make the road wider, and other people start to worry about whether the road is being designed appropriately from a pedestrian standpoint, from a bicyclist standpoint. So you have this tension between different user groups and different needs. Those are being decided by the road owner, but not by the funding source. Funding source would allow you to build a skinnier road or the wider road.
Follow up?
Thank you. I guess to address the point system, does a major collector as opposed to a feeder as opposed to a residential road score higher in the priorities, and would it behoove someone who really wanted a road to make it a major collector so they would score higher and get more points, therefore qualifying for the funding, where if they were doing an appropriate road, they might really just need a feeder or a small collector?
The decision on major collector is controlled by the DOT and is done actually by an entirely different group of people looking at national criteria with the oversight of federal highways and really trying to look at what the road is serving. Is it serving a large neighborhood and serving is sort of like a, you know, the road that serves a large area? Then it's going to become a major collector. But if it's one of the tertiary roads or secondary roads off of that, it would get a lower criteria. So the group asking for funding isn't making the decision on functional class. That's made for them by an independent review. In fact, we have a functional class review underway right now. It's the first one we've done in about 15 years, so it's long overdue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Salmon?
Question I have is the in this 2030 plan, do we have any major roads that's going to be in the 2030 plan, like Stampede Road, for example, that goes over to the north to west? I mean,
Representative Salmon, through the chair, what we're basically proposing is very few new roads. If you read the plan, we're saying unless there's a new source of funding that we at this moment aren't foreseeing, it would be hard to take on those kinds of new responsibilities. There's just a handful of new roads that are sort of reflected in it. And again, it was not trying to pick roads. In fact, I'm about to get to the numbers, and I want to take some time with that, but that may be the best place to answer your question when I get to these numbers coming up here.
Could I? Yeah. The reason for it is, you know, like the Pebble Mine, you know, I mean, is there plans in the 2030 for Pebble Mine if it does happen?
Well, in the Southwest Alaska Transportation Plan, which was done for that region, for the Pebble Mine area, it looked and said, you know, long term, way out in the future, 50, 60 years, there might be a need for a road from Cook Inlet all the way down the peninsula to the Chignecks or perhaps farther south. But it also said in that 20-year horizon of that plan, there's maybe three segments we should focus on right now. There are three very small segments in comparison to the hundreds of miles that you might want to build in the future. So even that plan done 5 years ago recognized the limitations of funding and how far it might go. And one of those roads, the Iliamna-Non-Dalton Road, which is kind of a side spur very close to the proposed Pebble Mine, has now become a lightning rod for people that are fearful of the mine. So they don't want the road to be built for fear that it might enable the mine to go forward more easily. I talked about that last week. It's a road where public support has gone from very strong to quite mixed.
Follow up?
just because of the Pebble Mine.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Keller?
Yeah, I'd like to go back to Representative Newman's question. Thank you. As you probably know, Representative Newman and myself represent the Mat-Su area of Wasilla. There are bumper stickers out there saying I drove through Wasilla and survived. You know, I mean, it's really, the growth is just really doing us under. My real question, though, is he was asking, or actually the borough has been asking us if we couldn't work on putting together something where they can kick money in locally, you know, and I think what their question is whether or not they can affect the timeline and the planning process. And I know it's a case-by-case question, but specifically, I don't know if you know about it or not, but Connect Goose Bay Road, the borough has built a connector and cannot get access onto Connect Goose Bay Road because it was, I guess, inappropriately timed with what the Department of Transportation has been doing or something. I don't, maybe you don't know anything about it particularly. But the real question is matching funds, you know, putting together, giving the community more power with the matching funds, you know. And we're exploring ideas, and I'm just really kind of feeling my way here on the question even. But
well, with matching funds, like I said, if it's major collector above, regardless of ownership, we're prepared to fund that. I should add that our policy on matching funds also applies to transit projects. We will fund transit projects because we feel that serves a group of users that really deserve to be served. They're often people that have no other means to get around, be they elderly or otherwise infirm or just simply at the low end of the economic scale. So the state is using match funds to help those type of projects. We are using them for higher level roads. And there's been a lot of talk about whether we should, you know, what the policy should be, because there, when times are good like they are now, it really isn't that much money to raise the match bond. But a few years ago, the legislature asked us to hold the line firm, and we've been doing that since that directive.
More specifically, I know my question was kind of vague, but is there a mechanism where, after the fact, once the planning is in process, that a community can affect the timeline on a project by kicking in local money?
Absolutely, in the scoring process, absolutely. Okay. That's the same answer I gave to Representative Fairclough. There's definitely, and Mat-Su has been one of our leaders in the state in recognizing they have a set of road needs and they need to come to the table to deal with that, as has the community of Anchorage and Juneau. Those would be the three communities I would point to that have really recognized that they share a role. It's not a universal feeling across the state. Some states, some localities, and I won't name them, have taken a different posture. So, and without state policy that drives that any differently, we have no other way to reward or not reward.
Well, let my presence temper your answers.
I wasn't even thinking of your community, Mr. Chairman.
And I realize I started this, and we'll have Representative Fairclough ask a question, but I'd like to refocus it back on your presentation after.
Thank you,
Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, it was in response to Representative Johnson's inquiry about driving projects becoming spending more money. That does happen on a local level. Local plans can, inside of the process, at least in the community of Anchorage, we looked at trails or amenities on the side of the road, and I believe inside of some sub-criteria for the national highway systems, I think there's some kind of demarcation for a 5% for amenities alongside the road, and then Anchorage chose to increase that to a higher percentage. So if you look at a roadway like 15th Avenue, some feel that's overdressed, some feel that's just a nice way to slow traffic down by those additional amenities and do that. So dollars can be ate up. It doesn't necessarily change the project out, but it does happen. And then, and it's usually by community request in the area. It's not DOT coming in and saying, let's do more. It is local communities and individual groups asking for amenity changes. And then in response to Representative Keller, one of the successes that we had at a local level was when you look at mega projects, there's any way to bust those into smaller projects. I thought that we were able to facilitate for the first time ever private sector contributions in the form of Fred Meyer, who actually came in, and to advance their project, we splintered off the Glen Highway project that hasn't gone forward as quickly, and we're able to provide a local community match actually from the private sector to come in and instead of bonding or others. So DOT has been responsive when people try to step up and save the state money, per se. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
think we're on slide 8.
Slide 8. Slide 8 is where we essentially have added up the cost of ownership for these three major modes of transportation, broken down into essentially the cost of improving that system, be it highways or ferries or aviation. We call that system development. The cost of life cycle management, which is simply the cost of being a good steward to the things you already own. If you do proper life cycle management, you preserve an asset and actually lower your total cost in the future because it lasts longer. It's said that $1 in pavement management expenditures will save $4 of rehabilitation in the not too distant future. So you spend $1 now or you can spend $4 later. Same thing with bridges. And then the cost of routine maintenance. And if you look at the highway bridge system, it's over $1 billion to be full ownership. And this is a bottoms-up analysis. These numbers were really, they spent a lot of time, our consultant did, in getting to these numbers. They're all documented. They come from as much data as we can bring to the table. Same for marine highways. Cost of managing that system is about $154 million a year, including fleet additions or replacement and refurbishment, recertification costs per year, working on the terminals, and then the O&M cost. And then finally for aviation, you see it's about $223 million to operate that system, to be the owner of that system, including bettering the system as well as maintaining what you have. I want to talk a little bit about that system development cost on highways in the next slide that we come up to, on slide 9. This is where we talk about a set of strategic priorities. You could say it's the most important of a list of very important projects. And we knew going in, we couldn't take the full $10 or $12 billion and just say, build that, because it's completely off the table in terms of funding. So we looked at really, I'd say, the most critical projects to the state, and I think if you put 10 people in the room, you'd probably get 80% agreement on the list, that people would agree at least 80% in common projects. There'll be a few projects that people say, no, take that off and add this. That's just the nature of our political process. But I think it was a fair look. We talked to our regions about this. We looked at it. And again, the important message here is not which projects make up the $5.5 billion. The important message is, if you wanted to do $5.5 billion worth of work in the future, how long will it take you to do that with current resources? And you're going to find out. Keep this $5.5 billion in mind as a straw man list without agreeing to what's in it, that it will show how long it takes to get it done under different funding scenarios in a later slide. So as you can see there, though, a very small amount of money, less than 10% for new roads. Almost everything else is some form of standards upgrade or a urban capacity improvement, including Anchorage, Mat-Su, Fairbanks on urban capacity. So on the slide number 10, which is unnumbered, I'm sorry, it looks like the numbering went away here for some reason, but the Alaska financing slide, there's some risk to relying upon the federal program growth. I could talk at length about what that risk is, but everything I'm learning about reauthorization gives me pause. If you kind of, right now with PPT just passed, we look really pretty good. But when this was being written, PPT wasn't passed yet. And everyone was saying, just a few years in the future with the decline in production of Prudhoe Bay, oil revenues don't look all that healthy. And some people would say that that's still true. Even with PPT, it's that 6-7% decline of Prudhoe Bay that is really going to come, we'll have to come to grips with. So the prognosis for general fund revenue long term is not great. We also have the issue that we've never had a dedicated fund for transportation, constitutional reality. We just haven't done it. And I think as a state, we've tried to look to the federal purse as much as possible. Although it's interesting, in early statehood, we Alaskans were pretty brave. We went from a 5 to an 8-cent gas tax increase at a time that made it the highest tax in the land in the early 60s. That stayed the same, and every other state now has passed us up. So we stood pat, and everyone else has run past us.
So on that, Mr. Addison, is the administration, DOT, looking at changes into that gas tax?
Representative Newman, no. And I think when you look at the governor's proposed Alaska Transportation Fund, which would generate at its start about $50 million a year, here's one takeaway number for you. We would have to raise gas taxes 12 cents or go from 8 cents to 20 cents. Achieve $50 million. with our small population base, it's really hard to generate adequate funding. And I think going that route would be kind of difficult right now. People see the surpluses in the bank, and they would ask, why are you raising my taxes in this era?
Including me.
So I think you get there other ways. And I think look at the Alaska Transportation Fund perhaps as a fresh idea that really has some merit.
So when I'm looking at this and I'm reading the 2030 Let's Get Moving plan that's laid out, this big plan, in these slides, we're trying to keep this $5.5 billion in mind.
You'll see in a minute what we can do with
that. And how we're going to pay for the numbers that we see in here
correlate
equally into here.
Yeah, you'll see, I think, in about two or three more pages, we'll start talking about how long different scenarios will get us to just getting that list. And let me just stress what's not on that list. There's a lot of state-owned projects that are not on that list, and there's a lot of local-owned projects that are not on that list. So it's a subset of needs, but it leaves a lot of things sort of unfunded, too. So you got to understand, as harsh as the numbers are going to seem, when you look at that short list of projects, it sort of begs the question, well, even if we can accelerate and get the short list done faster, where do we find the funding to do all these other needs that are still very much out there in public mind? And this would include the community class roads. So the top of the next page, the Alaska financing realities, most of the new financing strategies being used nationally, and there are a bunch of them now that are kind of coming to the front, just don't make a lot of sense in our state. It's just an awful lot of tendency now to look to tolls. Tolls are being used. State of Washington is about to toll an existing freeway. They're also going to toll an existing bridge, and they're going to toll the bridge several years before they rebuild it. So they're starting to toll projects before they even do the work that the public's paying for, which is a new concept. In the past, you got a toll once something was built, you got the toll, but you didn't get the toll well in advance of the construction. They're going to have a $6 toll to cross a 1 mile bridge in the state of Washington that's been in existence since the 60s. So. And they've concluded it's the only way they will get it built. All other funding sources have dried up.
Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out this is from the same state that brought us the container tax. So
yes,
I'm not surprised at anything that
would do. And the Port of Long Beach apparently has just passed a container tax too. So there's an idea that's now starting to leapfrog around the country. Just this week, they passed one. Many other taxes, so you've got what are called, the state of Colorado built a freeway, but built no on and off ramps. And if your area wanted an on and off ramp to use that freeway to get to it and get off it, get customers there, you had to build an LID, or do an LID, a local improvement district, and you would pay not only for the cost of the on and off ramps, but you're going to pay for part of the original investment in the freeway. So that was how Colorado did it.
Representative Salmon.
About 2-3 years ago, there was a person from Sleepy that sells gas, and he was complaining about the 8 cents tax that they charge the people in Sleepy for highway tax. Are they still charging that?
They still do, but that tax is actually going to the state general fund, so we don't know whether it ended up paying for schools or law enforcement or health care. Or transportation. There's no way of knowing because those dollars just go to the general fund.
General fund.
With that, could Representative Salmon find out so he can get to the people in Sleepmouth? How much is the DOT putting into that airport? I mean, what type of planning? So he has the capability to go to DOT and get that information to provide it to his communities?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. So, you know, in general, as we scan the country and we look at all these are all basically one form or another of user pay, you know, concepts. None of them really look very promising. There are a few spots where we might use them. I mean, we do use user pay in the ferries. We use user pay on our Whittier Tunnel, and we are proposing to use a user pay concept on the Kubota project. But I just don't think you're going to find it works on, say, the Rich Highway with 500 cars a day. It's just not a viable, practical alternative. So we're really not recommending that those techniques be considered in our state.
Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does it work on the Whittier Road?
it doesn't collect anywhere near the full cost. We're supplementing that by a couple million dollars a year.
So user pay doesn't really work in the sense of paying for what the user is using anywhere in the state?
Well, on the current ferry system, the user pay concept is paying for about roughly one-third of the total right. cost. On the Whittier Tunnel, I don't know what the receipts are, so I couldn't give you the ratio. On the proposed Kubota project, it's proposed that user pay would collect the vast majority of that project.
It's always
that may be the highest, you know, one of the densest corridors in the state.
It's always proposed that user pay pays the cost of the project, Mr. Chairman, as it was with the Whittier Road, but it doesn't really seem to hold out much hope that it's actually going to work except as a supplemental funding source on these
exactly.
projects. Thank you.
And I'll just give you one example. The Dallas Toll Authority is charging 11 cents per mile to use their toll road system. Well, if your car is getting 20 miles per gallon, that would be the equivalent of paying over $2 per gallon in gas tax. And that's on a high-density route in a very large urban area, probably with lower construction costs than we face here. So, I mean, everything's sort of stacked against us. We have high construction costs. We have relatively low volumes. So it becomes these ideas work elsewhere. And in fact, if you think about Alaska's reality, the federal aid program has always been good to us because we collect money all over the country, we put it into a national pool, and we get a much larger share than we personally contribute. We have benefited from this sharing concept. And once you go to user pay, where the dollars are collected in a given area and they work only back in that given area, that whole program that's helped us well for 50 years, we're left out.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Addison, so then you've explained quite a few different funding trends or options. The state of Alaska's DOT is still just, we're not going to increase the
gas proposing, tax, you know, in addition to the Alaska Transportation Fund, there are some other proposals in our long-range plan proposal. One is that we think
costs.
About returning to the LSR&T program, which is general funded, was general funded in the past. But it has the advantage of producing a set of dollars that can be used in a very cost-effective way. Federal dollars being used on some projects is just the wrong tool for the job.
And LSR&T is?
It's a program called Local Service Roads and Trails. Started in the 70s, carried through till the mid-80s, and then expired. Still on the books, still in statute, just hasn't been funded now for 20 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For some reason, this seems like it's one gigantic sponsor statement for the bill that sits in committee. Just an observation.
You've noticed that, too?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you, we didn't write this with that bill, knowing that bill was coming. That's a fact. It's from my standpoint, it's a happy coincidence.
Yeah, we'll see.
The slide here at the bottom, the two bar graphs, this simply tallies up the cost of ownership of the three systems that I showed on that table previously. It's a little over $1.4 billion. That's really the cost of being the owners of these systems and maintaining them and bettering them at a sustained pace. And then you look at the total amount of revenue that we receive, and it's about half of that, or about $700 million, round numbers. And some systems, if you look at the aviation revenues and compare it to the aviation cost of ownership, they're pretty close, they're just a little bit short. And if you look at the federal aid highway receipts compared to the highway needs, it's well under 50%. So different systems are situated differently in terms of how well they're being funded today. And I think that's an important takeaway message. While the state as a whole, it's about half of the amount of money we need, that's the degree of need is not the same among the different modes, highways and marine highways being the two that are most wanting for funds.
So our aviators are taking care of themselves.
They are, but there's still a dozen or so airports I'd love to see us figure out a way to get done, as Representative Salmon said.
Representative Salmon,
I have a question. You get I noticed BIA gets some road money. Do you guys work closely with them or on the designs or anything like that?
Which area is that, Representative?
Like, I mean, like they'll have roads in maybe Chalkeesic or Beaver. They have certain amount of, they get their money from that, I think it's 21T or something like that.
Oh, Ice-T?
The Ice-T, yeah.
Yeah, they're getting money through the BIA, through, I suspect, through the Indian Reservation Road Program, it's called.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and we are trying to collaborate with the tribes that get that money. There have been a few success stories. We need to keep working on it. It's we also, of course, are also doing projects with Denali Commission in several villages, bringing state match, Denali Commission funds. Sometimes we lead the project, sometimes they lead the project. There's actually, if you look at the rural Alaska, there's a lot of innovation going on. You got funding from about three or four different sources right now, including state funds through the Federal Aid Highway Program, Denali Commission funds, the BIA funds, which is a growing source of revenue. It's actually growing pretty rapidly. And then finally, in coastal areas, the coastal village funds that are coming from the fisheries. So,
follow up?
Yeah, don't tell Mike Kelly that I asked this question.
I think that that line of questioning goes with the question Representative Fairclough brought up last week. And I know we got the answers back from DOT. I'm not sure if that answered your question about using funds to the greatest extent, but it's another example of different funds that can be used in prioritizing which projects go first. So.
Yeah, there really is a lot of different money, and sometimes the biggest trick is how to do a project that has so many different kinds of money, because they each bring a different set of rules to the table, how they have to be managed, what NEPA process they go through. It's remarkably complex when you get for the project managers that have to make all this work when the funding is different. This slide here with the two graphs that has the three arrows on it, they just show you that how do you bridge that gap. The simple way to think of it is you constrain your needs, or you prioritize differently, or you increase your revenue, or you do combinations of those three major approaches. And we are proposing to do a little bit of each of those, and as you'll see, we get into the details of the recommendation. The first, and we then broke it down, we said there's three strategies here. We could have made more, but I think the three strategies represent a pretty good cross-section of a spectrum of strategies. You know, one is that you maintain your O&M and lifecycle management funding levels at about the percentage you do now, leaving some money left over for system development. And why is that important? Well, one, the public clamors for system development, perhaps more than anything else. Come and fix our road, widen our road, make it better. It also is part of our current economy. The consulting community, the construction community, and in fact, the DOT design staffs all have come to rely upon that. So if you stop doing that thing, then all those parts of the economy are left without a funding source. But what that means is there's some deterioration of the system because we're not maintaining it, we're not doing life cycle management steps to the level necessary. So some of your condition of the system starts to go down. And that $5.5 billion list of projects, that very narrow short list of a much bigger set of needs, wouldn't be completed until about the year 2041. That's a long time. That's a long time from now, 35 some years, 34 years.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Otteson, could you distinguish for me the operations and maintenance segment from the life cycle management segment, please?
Operations and maintenance are the things that you do every year to keep the system just there, putting down new striping, fixing guardrail, plowing snow, those kinds of tasks, the everyday maintenance activities. They tend to be not your system or life cycle management are the things you do that prolong the life of the facility. Crack sealing, ditching ditches so the water can get out, cleaning out culverts, those sort of major efforts. Chip sealing or repaving would fall under life cycle management. You actually see here, in some ways, it's our most intensive area of expenditure. Has been historically and needs to be into the future. It's the same thing owning your house and putting a new roof on it as opposed to letting the roof leak and then causing structural failure of the interior systems.
Yeah, thank you. So that there's some considerable amount of money being spent on things where if I was just as sort of a regular citizen driving by on the road, I'd say that was a maintenance operation, but you're classifying that as life cycle management.
Life cycle management.
Okay, right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The You know, just one takeaway. We now are taking $50 million out of the STIP each year and doing life cycle projects. We used to do that with general fund dollars, but as they started to ramp down, we said we've got to keep doing this. We've got to have some way to repave a road. So we now just arbitrarily have taken $50 million, which might have gone to system development, to ferry replacement, or highway widening, and instead we're spending it on chip sealing, crack sealing, and mill and pave type projects.
Does the federal government know we're doing this?
Yes, they do, and they consider preventive maintenance to be an eligible cost. They do not consider operations and maintenance. There's right. Kind of a fine line between bettering the system as opposed to just keeping it there. So another scenario is, let's focus on life cycle management operation and maintenance. Let's optimize operation and maintenance at the expense of system development. And so deterioration slows. You have a slower increase in the life cycle backlog of projects. But suddenly now your ability to address that set of strategic projects has gone from 2041 to 2064. You're talking about almost a lifetime. It's politically almost impossible for people to expect to wait that long for needs they can see today. You're talking about asking them to wait almost 60 years for a set of needs. It would be very, very, I think, difficult for the department, I think for people in your seats to see that policy implemented. So it's sort of a non-starter right out of the gate. And the third scenario is sort of equally a non-starter. Instead, you optimize on life cycle management. You put all your money as much as possible to manage the system we have, better our ferries, better our roads, not improve them to the point that you're widening them, but just you keep them smooth, you keep them maintained. You can't even perform operation and maintenance at the necessary level with the dollars we get. And there's no money left to mow down the backlog of that $5.5 billion list. In other words, it's not being done through infinity. This is a completely non-starter from a standpoint of trying to do a little bit of everything to keep all the needs addressed.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just sort of thinking about what you said about the second scenario, Mr. Otteson. If system development were all bottom up, then I can see the argument that you made that you couldn't just sit there and wait that much longer. I guess what I should do is ask you a question. How confident are you that what we're calling system development here is all in here because citizens are clamoring for it, rather than traffic engineers think it's a good idea?
Well, Representative Dugan, through the chair, just to take the Anchorage area, the projects in the municipality and the AMAT's long-range plan, done through a very public process, is what we used to develop that list of projects. We didn't add nor subtract from it. We simply said that list represents that public process, that identification of need. So it's widening the Seward Highway at the southern end of town to more lanes. It's completing the highway-to-highway connection, which has got strong support from the municipality and many groups. It's those kinds of projects. It's finishing the grid in Anchorage would be another way of looking at it, too, just finishing that grid of arterials and major collectors, like Dowling, et cetera.
Let me try that again. I'm not talking about necessarily about what the AMATS board would want or what the traffic planners would want or what would cause people to sit at the stoplight one less cycle. Mm-hmm. What I'm questioning here is whether you've actually given sufficient consideration to scenario two, or whether you've just decided that the minute somebody squawks, that plan goes out the window.
Well, I see the downside as being so large in my own mind that we would never be able to politically implement it. You would almost be shutting off whole sectors of the economy and just telling them that your services are no longer needed. That would be one almost immediate consequence of adopting that. You would be telling communities that your needs will simply have to wait for a very long time. That constrained list of projects is now out to the 2060 time period. And that too would have, I think, consequences just in the political support for one approach versus another.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We don't have to belabor this here. I think what I'm doing is questioning your definition of needs in that statement.
I understand that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. So if I can, I think I've given you kind of the three scenarios I'm trying to speed along because I know time is short. I wanted to just kind of talk quickly about our national transportation investment policy and how we stack up around the world, because I think understanding that, not only around the world, but around the country as a state, I think is an eye-opener. It was for me when we developed the numbers. If you look at Europe, the old continent, as we love to call it, you know, from our perspective, they are doing massive projects, projects that are really much bigger in scale and scope, everything from the tunnel to, you know, enormously large bridges, tunnels, et cetera, building high-speed rail. They're spending about 3.5% of their GDP on transportation. Keep that number in mind as we go through the slides. If you look at Asia, it's even more dramatic. Asia is building, China is building an expressway system that will be larger when it's done than the U.S. interstate. They plan on building it in a faster time period than we did the interstate. They and Japan and India are all building high-speed rail. In fact, one takeaway number is right now there are 13 nations with high-speed rail. If the United States doesn't get something going here pretty quickly, we will not be 14th. We will be later than 14th. So we're way behind in that particular technology. China is spending 9% of their GDP, and India about 3.5% of GDP on transportation investment. The United States is spending, as a nation, less than 1%. As AASHTO official said, we are sitting on the investment of prior generations and either sustaining it or bettering it. We've just simply sort of stopped that responsibility. We as a state are spending less than 0.5% of state GDP on transportation, and that makes us 44th among 50 states in the nation. And then if you ask the question, well, how do we stack up compared to the 6 or 7 other states most like us, states with large geography and small population base, and there's 7 of them that I identified, we're 7th among 7. So we're at the bottom of that list too. So even the Wyomings and the Montanas are outspending us, let alone the bigger states.
Representative Newman?
And just some comments and feedback, if you may. I can't, you know, somewhere in history I remember somebody saying it's the economy, stupid. You know, I mean, if we don't take care of that, and as legislators, help we take into these last couple of slides here, it's so critical as to the, I mean, trying to view Alaska from the 10,000-foot level. And if we don't have a transportation system so that we can grow our economy, whether it's at Pebble, as Representative Salmon talked about, or anything that we're doing, we're at a loss. And with our position in the Eastern Pacific Rim, Ted Stevens International, the third largest freight transporter in the world, you know, with the polar ice cap receding in the over-the-top route, you know, for ships, freight ships coming up through there instead of Panama Canal, it's only going to get more busy for Alaska. And now, you know, is the time. But the question I have for DOT is DOT prepared to make those requests to the legislature to get us to the point where we have to get to this, you know? Right now, when we're looking here, and we have Alaska spending less than 0.5% on gross domestic product, and we're ranking 44th, is DOT stepping up to the plate, coming to the legislature and saying, this is what we need so that we're not ranking 44th?
Well, DOT is going to introduce the proposed Alaska Transportation Fund. It would have happened today in Senate Trans, but it got delayed due to a chairman being stuck in his home city, but it was scheduled to happen right now, this very hour. That proposal is, I think, in my mind, the first real new idea to fund transportation, because gas taxes have been talked about for 20 years, and I've never seen anyone have the courage to truly put a bill in the hopper and let's actually get it passed. It's been a non-starter for decades. So suddenly we've got an idea of how to do this that is not so painful to the public. We are a state of resources. Why not rely upon those resources to help build our transportation? But I do think it's necessary. And I think as a state, I'll just give you, you know, kind of one thought. I remember in the Cooper administration, I was brand new at DOT, and someone, you know, we had heard about this need for some air freight capacity at Anchorage. and they had lost their ability to serve the passenger market because that whole thing had changed. The airplanes were not stopping in Anchorage because the 747-400 had been introduced, and it had longer flying capacity, didn't need a fuel stop in Anchorage. And they were seeing their landings go down and their economic future at the airport deny. And someone said, you know, if we build a couple roads down here to the north part of the airport property, we might get some lease lots sold to these UPS and FedEx that are talking about coming to Anchorage. And it was 1987. The budget, the price of oil was down in the $9-$10 range. You know, it was hard to get a capital budget of any size in the budget. But the state made that investment. And you could say that that little investment started a trend that has today makes Anchorage a marvelous economic success. Sometimes transportation investment is the foundation to the economy. And that's a clear example.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. And those bills, of course, I believe we have the companions here in this committee. And either way, whichever the vehicle is, we'll get a chance to talk about them here in this room. Representative Dugan and then Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Addison, I think part of the problem I'm having with this is that this presentation takes a look at what we would call, well, what's called on slide 9, strategic priorities for surface transportation. It's two different things. One is sort of a consumer product. So when you say demand driven by urban capacity is $2 billion of your $5.5 billion figure, that's basically drivers want more roads. So that sort of treats that as a consumer product. Then there's $1 billion where we would have to match federal standards. I guess it's a consumer project if we're spending money to make federal highway planners happy. I guess they're the consumers of that. And as you go down this list, you really don't hit a very big percentage of this $5.5 billion as money that has a direct impact on economic development. And yet, on the other hand, as we go a little bit farther along in the slides, suddenly we're talking about transportation as an engine of the economy. And I guess what I want to say here is if our consideration is that we need transportation development for economic development, as Representative Newman said, why is such a big part of the price tag here essentially transportation as a consumer product?
Well, I understand why you're characterizing it as a consumer product, but I think you can equally characterize it as an economic benefit. If you look at the new Elmore Road, just open, it by our estimates is saving the customers out there $10 million a year in travel time, fuel costs, etc. Just sheer benefits of the economic advantages of that. And that project, that means those consumer benefits will pay for that project in about 3 or 4 years, the entire state investment. The problem is there's no relationship to the benefits being generated
right.
And the state's ability to pay for it. They're coming from different.
It won't pay for that project. It may be able to get two sets of numbers that offset each other, but
right.
It's not really going to pay for
right.
that
there's
project.
There's no feedback loop because we have no way to
right.
for that to feedback. But if you look at communities where congestion becomes severe, you will find the people that complain the loudest are actually the business owners and the business leaders who say, this is affecting our economy, our ability to deliver goods, our ability for employees to get to work. Those become, I'll give you one example, in Seattle, the clamor for new capacity, urban capacity, is coming from Microsoft and Boeing and those types of employers who say, this affects us. This affects our economy, our ability to ship and receive.
Hello?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's true that people, you know, want to cut 5 minutes off their commute in Anchorage. And basically, they're as willing to spend as much of somebody else's money as it'll take to do that. But that's not exactly the same
as the
kind of expenditure as we're talking about when we talk about the necessity of improving transportation for economic development. All I'm trying to, I'm not trying to debate here. I'm simply trying to clarify. You know, if you take $5.5 billion or whatever it is, which is a lot of money even here, you know, and you're, if it's not all one thing, how much of it is one thing and how much of it is another? Because I think that insofar as the legislature are the policymakers here, we might be more willing to invest in one thing than the other, if that's the question that's put before us. And so we just kind of need to know which is which.
I think each project brings a mix of benefits to it. Some will jumpstart the economy because they make things possible. Others will make, maybe they're more consumer-oriented, as you said, or you know, making things more convenient for the public. Although economists will tell you that there are costs there to our economy as a whole. And those things, you know, the question is then, can we capture some of those benefits? If we make those benefits, can we capture them so that the cost of building the improvement is borne? That's the whole idea behind tolls, for example. That's really the fundamental principle behind tolls. People are willing to pay the toll because they want to drive a little faster and not see their time eaten up. I think some of these are in here. If you look at, for example, the special needs, the gas line, the truck weight restrictions are clearly have an economic benefit. Some of those rail benefits in the $1 billion there would be like the Port McKenzie extension. Clearly has an economic jumpstart characteristic to it. But your point's well taken, and I respect that.
Representative Johnson?
So I was, Mr. Chairman, you want me to continue? I know it's set 3. I'm happy to.
Yeah, we're fine. I think we're scheduled until 3:30. I think we're on half a percent of GDP, I think, where we start.
Yeah, half a percent. You know, in Alaska, we're collecting a half percent per mile, if you assume. Well, actually, a little bit less if you consume 20 miles per gallon. It's about 0.4 cents. Of course, that's going to the general fund. It's not directly helping highways, but it gives you some idea. But the cost to drive per AAA is much, much higher. It's 50 cents for the standard sedan, and it's almost 75 cents for the pickup truck or the large SUV. So we, as users of the transportation system, are willing to pay a lot to use it. We just aren't willing to pay a lot for the road we drive on. It's sort of the takeaway message, and it's sort of interesting. It's just the system has just really been starved for capital, yet people are already paying an awful lot of money to use that road. I've already given you the Dallas example, and I wanted to just talk on this next slide about the Constitution, but there clearly is a legislative mandate that we provide for the utilization, development, and settlement of our lands, use of our natural resources, and that we also, through the legislature, would provide for those facilities, improvements, and services that make that possible. And I found it useful to read this and not only to see the statements. I'll give you an example. One of the things we sometimes get criticized for is if we propose to build a road that might serve a private interest. We get criticized by people who are watching transportation policy. Yet, constitutionally, it's clearly a mandate that we will provide for the settlement of lands and the use of resources. And we may, as a state, make that happen through the development of facilities. It's interesting that the word transportation or highway is not found in our Constitution. So this is as close as you get to defining that relationship. Kind of going back to the three scenarios now at the bottom slide here. What is the most viable scenario? I've already telegraphed it, which is to maintain O&M and life cycle management at approximately the same levels, to try to do it a little bit more intelligently. We do a lot of what's called worst first in pavement work, and there's lots of national studies that tell you that worst first is kind of the wrong use of your dollar. But I think managers are on the horns of a dilemma. Worst first means if you have a limited pot of money for pavement management and you spend it on your three or four worst roads that are so torn up they just need to be completely redone, the money doesn't go very far. If instead you took the same dollars and you spread it over many more roads, extending the life of their pavement, you would get better payback. The problem with that approach is the people who live on those really bad roads and the representatives in the legislature who represent them are going to be on your case for not doing those roads first. So you're torn between the need to fix roads that have already failed, which is sort of the wrong use of the money from a management standpoint. And so what we're saying in the plan is we need to find a way to get out of worst first, which is what we're doing right now. But the only way you get out of it is you have to have an infusion of dollars to catch up on the roads, or the pavements that have failed. One key number, on the national highway system alone, $300 million of pavement have reached their useful life. That is, they're effectively failed. And the growth rate in that backlog of pavement is about $90 million a year. So we're losing about $90 million more a year each year. We're only spending $50 million a year on pavement management activities, and that's beyond the NHS. It's the NHS and everything else. So you can see just in that one metric that kind of problem is growing, not shrinking.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I want you to clarify that. Did you say in the states, or did you say in Alaska? Is that the number for Alaska?
Just on the national highway system alone, the 2,100 miles that comprise the national highway system.
Do we have any idea how much is it totally that we're responsible for?
We can tell you for the rest of the state-owned system. We don't have good numbers for locally owned roads. We aren't doing pavement assessment on those roads. But
can you tell me what it is for the state-owned plus the national highway system?
I would have to go talk to our pavement managers.
Thank you. At some point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, you know, there are some kind of focusing going on in the recommendations. One is the focusing is we continue to pay attention to the national highway system as our first priority. Again, it's where most of our use of the highway occurs. It's where most freight travels. It's where most people are driving their big miles, their high-speed miles. You know, I lived on a gravel road in front of my house for a long, long time, and sometimes it was potholed, sometimes it wasn't. But, you know, I didn't care that much because it was only a half a mile, and then I was on a state paved road, and life went on. So my road can be in pretty bad shape, and my commute wasn't really that big a deal. But when you live, when you're driving on 10 or 15 miles a day a really bad road, it's a different story. And so the question is, if you focus on those high-level roads, what do you do about the next tier, the tier that you're not focusing on? Because this is essentially triage, and triage is about the art of making hard priority choices. And it always leaves something undone, if you understand that philosophy. So, you know, the committee, the transition team for DOT strongly recommended that we do exactly this, that we focus on the NHS first. But I throw it out with a bit of caution because it's like worse first. You know, every time you direct your dollars here, you're going to leave something undone, and it's that undone component that raises the question: how do we get to that too? So you've seen here on the next slide the strategic project timeline. Under our scenario, we could only get to the $5 billion list by 2041. If we brought more money to the table and focused on that list, there is how fast we could accelerate it at three funding scenarios: $100, $200, and $300 million additional per year. So you can see if we get $300 million a year, we could have that list done in a decade. Something less, it obviously stretches out into another 10 years. So it's just a way of understanding how fast additional money would help you get to a prioritized set of needs. Bottom slide points out the obvious, but I think it's something that sometimes gets forgotten. Different transportation systems in this state are kind of in a different set of circumstances. Our state highway system and our rural airport system have no internal funding mechanism. The system managers are not allowed to adjust funding, set rates, retain revenue. Constitutional prohibition. At the same time, in the same state, we have other transportation systems, including our international airport system, the Port of Anchorage, which is municipality owned, but also the Alaska Railroad and Kibata. So three out of four of those are also under the same constitutional rules, but somehow they're going to be allowed to set rates, retain revenue, and actually, in some cases, even raise capital.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Addison, that brings up an interesting question. Now, you said that because of state statute, highways, rural airports, and international highways and airports, rural and state ones, have no internal funding permitted.
Right.
Is as a director within DOT, would you have suggestions, or are you working with the committee or the chair? You know, if you can think you can make life a little bit better or change this plan, or do you have any suggestions for that? I guess what I'm
I don't really, Representative Newman. I just pointed out for people to understand the difference. And, you know, I was recently looking at an airplane ticket when I went back east to a meeting, and I paid more. That ticket had more taxes in it than I'll pay as a citizen in road taxes in a year. One single airplane ticket. The airport system in our nation, they charge fees at every turn in the road. They charge gate fees to the airlines and fuel fees and landing fees and, you know, and they charge the taxi cabs that drive up to the airport. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. There are fees built in. There's fees on the tickets. And all those fees ultimately come back and make those airports what they are today, modern, efficient systems. So it's remarkable, their set of tools. You know, we're kind of like a utility. A road is, for example, is like a utility. It doesn't charge anybody to hook up to it. It doesn't charge anybody for the degree of use. You know, it kind of, in fact, in some ways, we're our own worst enemies. We bring traffic to nearby property. They then get to have that property value go up in the forms of, you know, lots of eyes in front of this store makes the property valuable. Then, because of all that success, we have to widen the road as a highway managers. And what do we have to do? We have to go pay for that enhanced value that we fundamentally created. It's just the system we're in. It's just how it works. You know, the road makes the property owner wealthy, and we have to then widen the road because of that success and turn around and pay for that value that we fundamentally created. I'm not suggesting we change it. I'm just pointing it out as one of the complications of the current structure we're under. I think that's essentially it. You know, you've heard my recommendation. It's slightly different than what we're doing now, and there are some risks. One of the biggest risks is we are assuming some continuation of federal funds at a very high level. And I'd love to talk to you about what's happening at the federal reauthorization, but there are some pretty bold ideas out there, and not all of those bold ideas would be beneficial to this state.
Any questions from the committee before we wrap up? I guess just one final question that goes along with Representative Johnson's request, that one of the policy decisions that you said was a long-standing department policy was not included in the long-range plan. How long are these long-range plans? I mean, do you anticipate, does it have to be done, obviously, before another major STIP amendment? Is it going to be done again? What if there's a policy, if it wasn't caught here by Representative Johnson, that is not put in the long-range plan? What happens if you wake up the day after and suddenly you realize there's a policy that's not in there? Again, hoop jump through, what the effect is. How is that practically, if Representative Johnson didn't catch that? What does that do to that issue if it's not in there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we had something like that happen on a project out of Illiamna on Dalton, where the state courts found our plan for that region at fault, not in keeping with state statute. It had to do with a cost-effective analysis not having been done for that project, which is actually in the statute. So we had to go and back up and reopen that particular plan, which is part of the long-range plan. Those area plans are really no easier, no harder to change than the long-range plan. Open it up. We spent about, I don't know, 6 or 8 months to do that, and then proceeded thereafter. And the court found that our, you know, with that change, we had done the right thing and could proceed. So, yeah, those things happen. Sometimes you have to open them up, but it's no different than doing a STIP amendment or a long-range plan amendment. And we will update the long-range plan typically every 5 years. That's about the cycle we follow. You know, more typically, we take about 2 years to do a long-range plan update, a lot more public involvement. We are rushing, and as I indicated, and we're rushing because the rules are sort of, you know, I don't think the federal rule took into account the fact that some states' election cycles may have a new governor, and a new governor wants to weigh in on their long-range plan. So in our state, the election cycle was right there in the middle of this process.
So you could remedy an omission in the long-range plan through the...
Through an amendment process. We could open it. But I think, you know, I don't think the recommendation of Representative Johnson would be a fatal flaw, that we couldn't still adopt that. But I think it's also, the flip side is, I think it's a policy that's important enough to be mentioned.
Okay. Anything else? I think we're done.
Thank you very much.
And we'll adjourn.